Welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Andras Tsifra, a political analyst who's based in New York and is the author of the blog No Yardstick, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis, or CEPA, and a contributor to the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Bear Market Brief. Andras, you were a guest way back in January of this year, January 3rd, almost 2 months before Russia launched its large-scale invasion of Ukraine. Thanks very much for joining me again.
Thank you. It's very good to be here. And indeed, it was a very, very different situation back then.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was the time when there was, of course, a lot of talk about Russia possibly invading, with the U.S. warning about this. It did happen, and a lot of people didn't expect it. And a lot of the things that have developed since then, I mean, obviously kind of unspeakable horrors, but a lot of the things that have developed since then were not expected at the time. So it's great to have you on the podcast again. Now, I see you as an expert on Russia's regions and on the ways that Kremlin policy affects what's going on across Russia in the provinces, and vice versa, kind of how what's going on in the provinces affects President Vladimir Putin and his government and its actions. And last month, you had a blog post, again, this is on No Yardstick, titled Low on Capacity, in which, and correct me if I'm not describing this well, but you looked at developments, including the mobilization that Putin ordered or decreed in September, and developments in the war, and how they've affected state capacity. Again, correct me if I'm misrepresenting, but in other words, how they affected the ability of the Russian state to implement its policies. So I'd like to ask you about this. Basically, how is the war and these processes, such as mobilization, what are their effects in Russia? Obviously, Putin and Russia have wreaked a staggering level of death and destruction in Ukraine. But at home, is the war threatening the government's ability to govern the country? And if this is the wrong question to ask, feel free to frame things in a different way and talk about what you've been finding.
I wouldn't say that this is the wrong question to ask, but let me just give a little more context. We started with how different things were or looked like in January. In a way, that is true. You were completely right about many analysts did not anticipate quiet was going to come. However, a lot of the deficiencies, shortcomings of Russia's model of governance, of the Russian economy, how it was organized, how it was the stewardship over the Russian economy, were clear back then, and analysts were accurate about expecting a full scale invasion to put a huge strain on these systems. And just as we see a lot of processes that were present before February 2022 in the Russian economy having sped up, for instance, Russia's loss of status as an energy superpower, which was going to happen at some point, but the war itself and the response to the war from the part of the European Union and the United States accelerated this process. And in the same way, endemic problems with Russia's system of governance were laid bare and were exacerbated by how the war has been going and how domestically Russia has been trying to, the Russian leadership has been trying to respond to these challenges. So my point even before the war, I think, would have been that there has for a long time been a tension between short-termism and long-termism in Russian policymaking. What I mean by that is that state capacity as such, which is the capacity of the state to sort of implement policies, to carry out visions, to sort of provide, to fulfill basic functions of the state, from healthcare to oppressive capacity. There are various kinds of state capacities. So that this kind of state capacity did exist in Russia and does exist in Russia, but this is either in some isolated pockets. So we have seen, for instance, the central bank is one of these pockets, or indeed the tax service, which under current Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin implemented a program that made it much more efficient. Or we can talk about, or we could mention the Gosuslugi state sort of government services system, online government services system. Or the state capacity is performative. What I mean by that is that when the state wants to be coercive, it can be coercive at certain important times and certain important parts of the state, but not always and everywhere. So it needs to rely on sort of these performative acts, cracking down on a specific sort of dissent, for instance, or cracking down on specific high-profile opposition figures, or cracking down randomly on protesters in order to seem bigger than it actually is. So for to give you a recent example, the Ministry of Justice will start publishing information, personal information, on people who are deemed foreign agents by the Russian government, which is, for those who don't know, is a label often used to sort of they're often used on the on dissidents of any sort, or independent journalists. And we have seen such tactics used in the wild, you know, with a degree of plausible deniability, where people's personal details were leaked, published, and they then suffered harassment. This is going to be the first time that the state is publishing these details itself and officially, and this sort of raises the specter of vigilante violence. Or so this is the what I call the performative state capacity, where when you want to be bigger than you actually are. And so, how does this come to play in the current situation? So over the past years, Putin has been more and more concentrating on foreign policy, on Russia's place in the world, and he gradually sort of faded into background in domestic politics, in the sense that he was still obviously still there, but the minutiae of domestic politics, how the state was governed, was gradually given over to the government. And together with this, we have seen a conscious effort to make the system run itself. So this was, again, tied to Prime Minister Mishustin. But in reality, what we have seen is that even though Mishustin and his government have been building a system that relies on large-scale data collection, on sort of collecting information on various subsystems, from, you know, regional politics to various economic sectors, to be able to react before something gets out of hand. In fact, the system itself, really, the way it works in practice, really keeps relying on personal relationships, people thinking up solutions that are rather, you know, haphazard, and on manual control. Governors, when they are appointed by the federal center, usually come up with their own team, and because they find it difficult to sort of govern a region where they are not part of the elite, so they bring in their own people. they are often looking for cues from the center. How far can we go? What can we do? What is expected of us? Their fiscal space is very dependent on relationships with the center and specifically with the president. I would say more and more dependent because due to the war, tax receipts, including the two most important tax receipts that regions rely on, the corporate income tax and the personal income tax, they are both falling. Corporate income tax started falling earlier than personal income taxes, but that is also coming. So to summarize it, I would say that these efforts to make this a sort of a well-run system that is able, that the federal government is able to oversee and able to sort of manipulate quite easily isn't really that has run against the basic instincts that such a very highly centralized and very personalistic system has created. So what we have actually seen, and this is where I come to the mobilization, military mobilization, is that the Russian government is trying to do a thing, or trying to basically do a thing that has already failed during the COVID crisis, failed in practice in terms of state capacity, although it worked for the regime, namely that they that governors are made responsible for figuring out how and where they are going to implement the policies to get the results that the state wants to see from them. In that particular case, it was lockdown policies, basically, or restrictions. Lockdown was, after a while, a dirty word. It shouldn't be used, but restrictions of movement and then vaccinations. And the state gave them sort of results that they have to achieve. But when it came to how to achieve them and means were used to achieve them was more or less left up to governors. And we see more or less the same with mobilization now, in that governors are playing a very outsized role in military mobilization. And part of the reason why I think Putin issued no decree ending mobilization is that the expectation is that in regions where it can continue with a fairly low level of risk, it will continue. And in regions where the local governor deems that it's too risky to mobilize, draft more people because there is organized resistance, or there is or it's not risky, but it would affect key industries, then it will stop or it will be on pause. But sort of it gives just like during COVID, there was no clear end to movement restrictions or the vaccination drive. There's no end for mobilization. Only now, of course, this touches nerves much more because the stakes are much higher. There's simply more at stake for governors as well as for citizens. So far, I would say that, to answer your initial question, that the situation hasn't really made it impossible for this system of governance to run, because what we have seen so far is more or less expected. People blame governors for the failures of mobilization. They record video messages to them, and then governors do what they want with those messages and those complaints. And they have been reacting in rather different ways to them. And it's up to them. This is how the system is supposed to be run. But over time, as regions run out of financial resources, and over time, as sort of dissatisfaction runs from region to region, and some regions have very, very different capacities to sort of alleviate these this discontent and others, this may become significantly more more difficult. And mobilization is open-ended. It's not, and the war is open-ended. It's very difficult to sort of plan, either if you're a governor or if you're a an enterprise working for working in a specific region. So it's more difficult to sort of manage expectations of what is about to come than during COVID. So this is what I mean when I say that state capacity or the problems with state capacity are laid bare, and this is a bigger crisis than COVID.
That's very interesting. The one thing I just mentioned is kind of you mentioned the difference between performative, I guess, state capacity, including these essentially crackdowns, this development that they're going to start naming and issuing details, information about so-called foreign agents, and kind of real state capacity or you know abilities to implement policies, and also I mean the very interesting comparison with the COVID or with the COVID situation. I mean, it struck me at the time when COVID began to appear in Russia that this was going to be kind of a big test of a leader who has in many ways kind of run on propaganda. And this was kind of a real crisis that was coming and a test of his ability to deal with it. And now we have a new crisis that's entirely made by the leader, but is again testing state capacity. And as you say, it's open-ended. It's, you know, it's a bigger crisis than COVID, and it's one that we really don't know when it's going to end. So, but thanks very much for those insights. Now, in addition to state capacity, you wrote about regime capacity, which you described as the ability of the government to provide favorable outcomes for the group whose active cooperation it needs to govern. So I guess that would be sort of the elites, people around Putin in kind of circles that go out from the Kremlin. And you wrote that regime capacity in Russia was declining. Now, this was about a month ago after a strikingly successful Ukrainian counteroffensive in the Kharkiv region and part of the Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine. And that was one of numerous setbacks for Russia on the battlefield. And since then, there have been more. There's been at least one more major setback for Moscow, the Russian retreat from Kherson in the south and the right bank of the Dnieper River there, or Dnipro. And Kherson, of course, was the only regional capital that Russian forces had managed to seize since the invasion in February. And we've seen clear signs in the so-called Russian elites, not of opposition to the war, but of dismay over how it's going for Russia. And that there are various, various kind of tenors to this dismay. So I guess the question I'd ask is, how is regime capacity looking at this moment?
So first of all, I think we should separate. So we should make a distinction between federal elites and lower level elites, or like even down to people who are co-opted by the regime. So about federal elites, I am not going to speculate because there are many sort of better informed people, so to say, who have been writing excellent articles about how the developments of the past couple of months have created or exacerbated existing doubts in federal elites. But when we go down to when we look at the whole system as it works, so as a whole, and not just the people around Putin who we think may or may not be able to influence him, or may or may not be able to conduct a coup, if the situation gets there. So if you just look at the whole regime, one of the there are various complex sort of relationships that underlying understandings that the system's capacity to exercise power relies on. And this is not just people sitting in Moscow. This is also people sitting in the regions, people also sitting in I don't know, municipalities or regional governments. And what I was trying to highlight was that apparently there have been these rumors that even officials, lower level officials, were finding it suddenly difficult to get their relatives, their sort of extended family, friends, or so on, out of military mobilization. And the pressure was simply too big, and or the system clogged up, and their sort of calls did not get through. What this does is that it sort of erodes the willingness of the people whose active cooperation is needed to govern, because the system is not able to guarantee favorable outcomes for them at crucial moments. So another such thing that Mark Galeotti highlighted recently was that there is less upwards mobility from the regions to Moscow, and that's something that also sort of makes people in these lower rungs feel like they are stuck where they are, and that they have to sort of find ways to get ahead where they are. And in situations in which the regional governing system is relies on basically people who are federal officials or officials from other regions, posted to regions, and they need a certain degree of acquiescence of the either the local security elite or the local business elite to govern. This might create situations in which where loyalties are going to get questioned. So I'm not saying that this has already started, although there have been in the past couple of years, not since the war specifically, but in the past couple of years, we have seen indications of where regional officials or local officials sided with local either protesters or made deals with local businessmen. So that's what I mean when I'm. This is happening at the same time as these regional officials are asked to sort of carry out a growing number of functions, and mobilization was just one of them. But they also have to keep local economies running. They have to make sure that there are no crippling problems with labor, for instance, strikes. They have to make sure that there are no empty shelves in stores. That's something that Putin told them in, I think, April, soon after the economic troubles started because of the sanctions. So they have to do all this, and now they like some of them will have more sort of leeway legally to ensure that they are able to carry out these functions. Putin's degree on partial martial law, as I call it, which established the different the varying degrees of readiness in Russian regions, based on how close they are to the front end war, has accorded to governors varying degrees of extra powers to make sure that the, for instance, the military's needs are catered to. But there's a lot that you can sort of shove into those extra powers if you want to, if you really have that inclination, and if and if, as I have mentioned, you are trying to get ahead locally because you can't expect to enjoy that upwards mobility in your career. So so this is one thing. And the other thing that I think is important to mention with the elites, be they federal or local, is that timelines are shifting. And in a way, they have already shifted over the summer. So it's not there were long-term costs that a couple of months ago might have seemed avoidable, but they're but that are not avoidable anymore. So various export markets, for instance, or capital expenditures in the regions that sort of underpin investment where at a time when investment comes from nowhere else because of the general uncertainty. So these are long-term costs that are lost for economic elites, people who are active in regions, and also for federal officials. So as long as things are going reasonably well, and there is, and the dominant narrative is that Russia is either winning this war or at least is able to drag it out for long enough that in the end it will either grind down the West and Ukraine and slash or also win it, then the opponents of the war, the opponents of the regime are, their best strategy is to remain silent because they would be speaking against the narrative, right? Like, if obviously not everyone will, but most of the people will out of fear. And the supporters of the regime, or the sort of who are just enjoyers of the regime or enjoyers of the situation, will stick with it and will keep supporting the regime. But the problem is when this narrative is questioned, and I think the two offensives, the Kharkiv counteroffensive and the Kherson counteroffensive, questioned this narrative, and that can trigger changes that we are that are difficult to foresee, but that so but that sort of tells people in Russia that they are that what they have been hearing about the war and what they have been expecting might not be true, and the war may have been longer and the cost may have been higher or may be higher in the future than they anticipated.
All right, so thanks a lot for that. And I guess one thing that you're talking about is kind of a tension between the fact that on the regional level, leaders are being asked to do more and to do a lot of things, but at the same time, there's less upward mobility and also, I guess, increasing kind of questions about the future. I am going to turn to questions now, and we have one question that's come in from, looks like, Stephen Jones. The question is, I mean, it's kind of about these tensions. The question is, how much confidence should we have in the recent Newsweek story about the leaked email from an FSB agent whistleblower, Wind of Change, I guess I would add reported, in which it was claimed that Russia is facing a, quote, inevitable civil war, and Russia will soon, quote, descend into the abyss of terror, unquote, as people grow increasingly tired of war. So I guess there's kind of the kernel of this question is, you know, are these tensions, you know, leading toward civil war?
I have been, I would be very cautious about trusting any sort of leaks at this point from the FSB. We have seen a lot of these stories over the past 10 months. And what I would advise is always to look for, like, these stories come out for a reason, but it doesn't, so it is worth analyzing them, or it's worth looking at them and reading them, but it's not, I would advise against taking them at face value. So what I can tell about the, like, civil war and the FSB is that for a long while now, Russia's domestic politics have been securitized. The language has been the Russian government regards domestic politics have been taken over by the language of national security. So what does that mean? It means that an increasing array of things, of policies that would otherwise be regarded as just policies, so from cultural policies to environmental movements, have been regarded as suspect, as somehow directed from abroad or directed by subversive elements and sort of a threat to Russia's national security. This is good for the security elite, because it allows them to sort of increase their clout domestically. Indeed, besides the military, the other two groups of officials that seem to be untouchable when it comes to budget cuts are the presidential administration, obviously, and the broadly defined security services, the Siloviki. Their allocations are growing very steeply, and that is both an indication of the sort of the anxiety of the government, of how well or not or unwell things are going, and what is ahead, and also an indication of this increased clout, and that is based on this sort of security focused view on domestic politics. So, you know, any leader suggests that the FSB is expecting a civil war should be, I think, viewed through this lens. But I don't think, or I don't see an indication at all that Russia is in the foreseeable future going to descend into a civil conflict, as many are suggesting, along, I don't know, ethnic lines or along the lines of certain regions breaking away from the center. I might be wrong about this, of course, but I just don't see anything suggesting that presently, since regional elites are co-opted, and they have a very low degree of fiscal independence and control over resources. Obviously, there are exceptions, like Chechnya, for instance, which, on the one hand, has a history of independence, of an independence struggle, and a very localized elite. But on the other hand, is very dependent on transfers from Moscow. So, and then there are other examples like Tatarstan, which has significantly more resources than Chechnya, on the other hand, its elite is very well integrated into the Russian elite. So whenever we talk about these, we talk about the chances of Russia just falling apart, we should consider whether it would make sense for the people who actually wield power or who could wield power in a certain region. And I just don't see any indication right now, even though I obviously need to acknowledge that there are nascent independence movements that have been sort of boosted by the toll of the war on certain regions and certain ethnic groups in Russia, or the perception that that the war is somehow just trying to pick a word very carefully. The war is somehow sort of eliminating, consciously eliminating certain ethnic groups in Russia, which is a narrative that has come up in certain poorer regions where that have been indeed that have suffered indeed a bigger toll, and because their men were overrepresented in the army, right? So, but it's right now it stops there, and Russia's not going to. I seriously doubt that Russia is going to fall apart tomorrow or as soon as the war is lost.
All right. Thanks a lot for that detailed answer to that question. And I guess as you're saying, there are these tensions, there are these problems, the disproportionate representation in the military and I guess in the on the front itself, and frankly in the body bags that are coming back, of certain regional and ethnic groups, but this is not necessarily going to translate into some kind of action. So thanks a lot for that response, and happy to take more questions. So give it a few moments. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, you can hit the button in the Twitter space to request to speak, or send a direct message, or post your question as a reply. Hit the reply button in the Twitter space. Okay, looks like we have one coming in. Just a minute. Bear with me. Appreciate your patience. We do have time for at least this one question. Okay, so I think it's a bit off topic. What assistance is being provided to countries being targeted by Kremlin influence ops? So I'm not sure. That may be a question. Yeah, go ahead if you want to respond.
I just want to highlight that it's a little it's a little vague, right? Like I'm not sure. What are we talking about? Who is providing assistance? What assistance is being provided by who? Kremlin influence ops. What kind of Kremlin influence operations are we talking about? Information operations or political influence operations or espionage, or there are so many different ways in which this can be phrased. So at this point, I just don't know what question to answer.
Yeah, that's fine. Let me just, I'd like to ask a question that occurred to me during your first response to my first question, which is, you mentioned this kind of performative state capacity, I guess essentially doing things like cracking down on so-called foreign agents and that sort of thing. So essentially the clampdown and then the other kind of state capacity. So my question is sort of, does the kind of, I guess, what I would call negative or forceful, the use of force essentially by the state to get things that it wants done, to suppress the opposition and dissent, does that kind of take away from the state's ability to implement policy in things that are essentially positive, such as healthcare, that sort of thing?
I mean, it certainly does in the sense that the budgetary allocations that go to security services do not go elsewhere. Same thing with the military, obviously, and same thing with the war. Like, the war also takes away the Russian budget's ability to ensure that the state is a positive actor, and the state maintains these big systems of that the people rely on, from healthcare and education to investment into infrastructure and so on. So, if you look at and now I'm talking about the federal budget, but obviously the regional budget, depends increasingly on the federal budget in times when their own revenues are falling. So at the very beginning, when revenues started falling this year in the federal budget, were outlays on science and technology, on transportation, on various other investments. One of the even goals that were defined just months ago, like, for instance, when when Western sanctions and the withdrawal of Western companies from Russia sort of collapsed the Russian automotive industry, the first answer of Putin was to instruct the government to come up with a new sort of development strategy for the industry. And on the side, he also said that maybe just car ownership should be helped by building more gas stations across the regions, which I will leave it up to everyone to decide whether or not this would have worked the way it intended. But my point is that months later, exactly this kind of program was cut down. So between April and, I don't know when exactly it happened, maybe September or October, the state took a complete U-turn on, like, this is a small thing, but it is emblematic of larger policies being sort of sacrificed on the altar of providing more sources, more resources for the security services and police and the and riot police and so on, because the state's view is on domestic politics is informed not by the necessity the view that the state takes domestic politics is through security, and it's not through providing various services. That's actually left with governors again. To ensure that these sort of vital services that the state provides, which of course is also a major focus of regional budgets, education, social aid, and healthcare, that these do not collapse enough to sort of lead to protests or discontent that can spread to. Spread beyond control, but it's a choice, and therefore, yes, it certainly does negatively affect the ability to to build state capacity in sort of more benign ways.
All right, thanks very much. That's fascinating. It seems like sort of a major problem that existed in Russia long before the invasion. So thanks for that. Okay, let's wrap it up here. Andras, thanks very much for joining me again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, once again, I've been speaking to Andras Toth-Sifra, a New York-based political analyst who is the author of the blog No Yardstick, a non-resident fellow at SIPA, and a contributor to FPRI's Bear Market Brief. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFARL. As I mentioned, this conversation will be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFARL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back for another installment of The Week Ahead in Russia on November 28th. And please keep an eye out for the next edition of my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on December 2nd, on Friday. Thank you for listening.